Welcome to the Fairest Love Podcast, where we share spiritual and practical ideas for how to live family life with a beautiful, self-sacrificing love. On the show today, we're speaking with Dr. Julia Sadusky, licensed psychologist, speaker, and author of the book, Talking With Your Teen About Sex. Julia works with clients from a myriad of backgrounds, but has specialties in sexuality, gender identity, mental health, trauma-informed care, and the intersection of sexuality, gender, and theology. Julia will be speaking with us on how we can begin the conversation about sex with our children so that they can best be prepared to face the challenges presented in culture. Thank you so much, Julia, for being on our show today.
Yes, it's great to get to talk to you.
I just want to dive right in and actually go ahead and talk about your book that you wrote, Talking With Your Teens About Sex, and then also kind of your background and how you became a psychologist and what you're doing with your counseling services now.
Yeah, so I wrote a 2-book series, Start Talking to Your Kids About Sex and Talking With Your Teens About Sex. Very obvious what we're talking about there. And the spirit of those books really came out of conversations with friends, family, and clients, where in a very short time, I was getting a lot of the same questions about, with young children, how do you handle things like exploratory play, where a child might touch their own genitalia or somebody else's, almost as a way of being curious about their environment, and how do parents handle that without overreacting or underreacting? And even just other experiences, questions when a kid asks about, you know, terms for their body parts, what language do you use? And I started to realize that there really wasn't anything out there available to families from a Catholic perspective that was updated, and from a psychological perspective as well. And so that sprung me into wanting to write Start Talking to Your Kids About Sex. And then Ave Maria Press, who I was working with, reached back out and said, yes, we love that idea. Can you write 2 books, one for parents of teens as well? And my specialty really is in adolescents and emerging adults. So it's an obvious kind of extension of what I already do. And so that's, yeah, a little bit about where that work came from. And as you mentioned, I'm a licensed psychologist in Colorado, and I have a private practice here. I work very broadly in the area of sexuality, can include a lot of things, as you can imagine, compulsive sexual behaviors, sexual orientation exploration, gender questions, marital kind of challenges with intimacy. So work in a lot of those spaces. And I also have a specialization in eating disorders. And so I work with people with eating disorders and complex trauma in the midst of all these other pieces.
Wow. And I'm curious with, you know, just your experiences in your practice, as well as when you were writing this book, the teens one specifically, how did those experiences, like those questions that came up within your time with your clients, like how did those inform what you would include in how to talk? And we'll go a lot deeper into it, but just kind of based on a basic kind of outlook on it.
Yeah. So if you look at the table of contents, I really wrote the chapters as if they were questions from parents. So I just tried to take a step back and say, what are the key questions parents are asking me? And if they're not asking me, what do I wish they were asking me? And so things like, I think, dating or sexual intercourse are probably the things parents think of most when they think of the sex talk in adolescence. But there were a lot of things emerging for me, bodily changes, attractions as such, and boundaries in dating, responding if you're getting comments about your body that are not appropriate or helpful, technology use, obviously masturbation, pornography. These are all the areas that come up a lot in my practice. And usually I'm in the position as a therapist to be reactive with families, where they come to me in crisis after something has happened and they're reeling from maybe a disclosure of something that people aren't sure how to handle. And so I thought, how do I help parents be proactive and give them the information ahead of time, even when they feel like it's not really relevant? The hard part is it's not relevant until it is. And usually you have a teen in front of you at that point really needing a lot in terms of support and calm. And what parents often understandably give is those kind of reflexive reactions.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is the biggest challenge for parents even to approach
conversations about sexuality with their children, just even start. Cause I think you, like you said, a lot of it's a reactive, like, oh, you know, they're not really sure how to respond. Mm-hmm. What is the challenge to even start those conversations to begin with?
Yes, I've thought a lot about this because even in the teen book, I write a whole chapter on helping parents explore a little bit about their own story of sexuality and just how their own parents kind of talked about these things. And because I was meeting with a lot of parents who really do want to have these conversations. They see the value of it, and yet there's a gap between seeing the value of it and effectively doing it. And so I started to think more about just how modeling has a big impact on parents. And if they didn't have good role models for how to have a lot of different conversations comfortably, it's really difficult to kind of make that happen out of thin air. And so I think that is one really important piece of the puzzle, is that's a barrier. If I don't know how to do this effectively, I know what I don't want to do. That doesn't tell me what to do and how to do it. I also think that there's definitely experiences of sexual shame that we all kind of walk into relationships, marriage, family life with, that can make it hard because it feels like sexuality is something bad and only able to be talked about maybe theoretically or theologically. And there's a hope that we'll just know how to talk about it in contexts that are appropriate. And yet that doesn't translate into these skills to have pretty nuanced conversations. And so I think shame can come up. And then the last thing I'll say for now is I definitely think unwanted sexual experiences or early exposure to sexual content can make parents swing in the other direction of, I'm not going to go here because it brings up my own feelings about whatever past experiences shaped my sexual script and the understanding of sexuality. And so I really can appreciate why it's so challenging for parents to go there. And yet I want parents to know and understand and validate what's so challenging for themselves. And then also begin to identify, how do I overcome those barriers? Where do I turn so that I'm not just hoping for the teenage years to have these conversations and avoiding them?
That's very powerful. What do you think about... So you have these two books, you have one starting to talk to your children about their sexuality and sex, and then you have your teen book. What are some things that parents can do to start to have those conversations, or even, like you had said, modeling? Like, what are some models or things that they can start when their children are young so that ideally when the time comes to have the more serious, intense conversations about things, it's open and it's a open discussion?
Yes. So I would say the biggest thing that I would recommend to parents with young children is teaching them accurate terminology for genitalia. It feels like such a odd intervention in the scheme of things. Why does that matter so much? And that's a good question. It matters so much because we actually know from research that the number one protector against childhood sexual abuse is a child knowing the accurate terminology for their genitalia. And so what you're doing in that is you're actually, you're actually buffering against one of the really powerful impacts on a child's sexual development when you do that. But not only that, you're positioning yourself as an expert in the room about human sexuality. So if you say to a child, oh, yes, that's your vulva, well, that child now knows mom knows more than me or dad knows more than me. And any chance you get to instill that sense that I'm the one that you can come to talk about any of this by a calm demeanor and initiating the conversation in a gradual way, it's going to serve that child to say, oh, my parents know what they're talking about here. And that comes into things like, you know, teaching a child that they don't have to hug a stranger, that they can greet them and five other ways and decide how they want to do that. And it involves things like talking through sleepovers. If you do that in your family, it involves, you know, just engaging around exploratory play? How do we teach kids what's appropriate and what's not appropriate with certain parts of the body? And we do this with other parts of the body as well, but how do we teach that with private areas of the body? So those are some of the pieces in, you know, early childhood. And then as kids get more curious about words like sex, you know, you can give them kind of a foundational definition, like, oh, sex means there are two sexes. There's men and there's women, boys and girls. So dad's a boy, I'm a girl, you're a blank, right? And there's other meanings of sex as well. And as you get older, those are conversations that we're going to get to have together. So if you were to hear something about that, there's nowhere else I'd rather you go than to mom and dad to talk about those things. Friends sometimes talk about this, cousins, you know, older siblings. And so you can always bring those things to me and we can talk about it more.
Yeah, that's great. And it's not like a, oh, you know, like what are you talking to me about? It's, and you were just saying, like what you said, you were laying the foundation earlier on with those little things that are not as like significant, I would say, in the sense of this conversation, but that they're the ability for the child to really recognize that they can come to their parents to talk about these things. And as it gets, the more you do that, what I'm hearing is the more you do that, the easier it'll be for those children to come to you after.
Correct. And easier for you as a parent, right? Yeah. To navigate what comes next. Because as soon as you have the formula of what to kind of, yeah, how to approach it, I think it gets a little bit easier each time. Mm-hmm.
And what would you, so as we're kind of sitting here now thinking about 2024, just the world that we're in with technology, and I know you had mentioned that a little earlier, but what do you think is kind of one of the biggest challenges that teenagers face these days with understanding their sexuality as it is addressed in social media, in the different platforms? What are some of those challenges that you're hearing that teenagers face? And then, and how can they, I guess, address those?
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind is simply access. I think especially post-COVID, the line between, you know, doing homework and being on TikTok is completely gone. Mm-hmm. And so a teen can be in a space alone and have instantaneous access to so much information and have no practical skills to filter that through. I mean, for those of us who weren't growing up on social media, we have more skills because we had plenty of time to not be on social media. And we know what it feels like to engage and disengage a little bit better. I mean, we still have our challenges, but once you get to these younger generations, nobody taught them. And the parents often don't know how to teach it because they didn't have to navigate this themselves again. So on a fundamental level, just relating to it, accessing it in ways that are mature and wise is not something that teens know how to do and parents know how to scaffold very well. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times then this opens up the door to just a bottomless access to information of varying degrees of accuracy. So, you know, certainly this comes up with early exposure to pornography, just sexual content that's targeting young people in particular ways, especially, you know, young men, young women, usually targeted more with body kind of commentary or imagery that can promote eating disorders. These things that we didn't have to navigate in quite the same way historically. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, I think it's front and center in a lot of people's minds that the conversations about sexual orientation and gender identity have really expanded rapidly and shifted a lot of people's understandings about sex differences in a pretty profound way, rather quickly in about the last decade. And so, again, a lot of parents feel like they're on their back heel trying to have a conversation when the teens have so much information from online sources that it feels like everybody's just speaking past each other and nobody's bringing their best self to the table. And so those are probably some of the nuances I hear. There's a lot I could say about the specifics of pornography and just the kind of themes that come up in that with teenagers today, especially, and how that's impacting teens and traumatizing teens pretty profoundly without parents ever being really privy to that. And so I think of that as well as we're talking about this.
Yeah. And you had mentioned, I mean, too, like the gender, a gender identity. And do you see, let's say with your clients or even just with your research, do you notice that this gender confusion or, it's based in their misunderstanding of their sexuality? Like, I don't know how to ask this in a way that's like their dignity as like a child of God. I know that's a very like Christian terminology, but just even do they experience that? I mean, just are they missing that? And that's kind of what they're craving, you know, in that sense, and which is why they're misunderstanding their sexuality. I don't know if that question makes sense.
Yeah. So I think everybody's trying to figure out like what's happening for people in that space. And it's such a complicated area of life, right? Embodiment and people's connection to embodiment. I mean, we live in a time where we're probably less connected to our bodies in meaningful ways than ever before. Perhaps technology has a lot to do with that. The pace of life has a lot to do with that. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that for most of us, we have a really strong grounding in embodiment and then by extension, groundedness in our sense of self as a child of God. So I think that's true for everybody. And I certainly see with people asking questions about gender and sexuality, a wondering if I have these questions, does that preclude me from a relationship with God? Mm. So maybe that's a way that shows up. I feel like I have to have this all sorted and clarified before I can approach God. And so that can be a barrier to a relationship with God and knowing kind of how to approach him at all in my experience and challenges. Mm. I think that with gender in particular, you know, certainly there are people with gender dysphoria, which is a mental health concern where there's incongruence about your experience of embodiment. So the person you see when you look in the mirror does not match your experience internally, and that can be very painful. Mm. I think there are people who identify as transgender or use another label and they don't have gender distress. They're kind of adopting these terms to convey something about their experience at a time when a lot of those categories have expanded. I think that has something to do with what we're seeing. There's also teens who are simply asking questions, who am I? And they would have asked that in other ways in different times in history. And today they're asking that in the realm of gender. So I think that has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. And certainly philosophical ideas about sex and gender that have been building for a long time have an impact here in how people think of themselves, and feminist theory has a lot to do with that. And just as far as the trickle down effect of that on how people start to conceptualize identity. So I think there's a lot to it, and it differs person to person, but make no mistake, right? These kids are asking questions that their parents didn't ask usually. And parents are feeling really ill-equipped, I think, to respond effectively.
Right. Yeah. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on. So when in discussing identity, but also just like sexuality with your children, do you think that there is a difference between how you would explain it with your daughters versus your sons or with boys or girls? Should there be the same kind of conversations going on with both of them? Or does it, I know there's a lot of like, it depends on the child, but like, does it also depend? Like, should some girls know this over that?
Great question. Yeah, I've thought a lot about this with the books and even the teen book in particular. How do I format it to account for the fact that there are some pieces that are very specific based on sex, and then there's some pieces that are general. Like, what's general? Well, hygiene would be something that is a general thing to talk about, or a shaving within that. being able to know what's happening to the other sex is actually really important, I would say. And I think that's a missing piece. Sometimes we say we're going to talk to the girls about girl stuff. We're going to talk to the boys about boy stuff. And we're not going to talk to the boys about what's happening for girls and vice versa. And for kids who are moving through puberty, they tend to be curious about that. And that's where they can start to look online at pornography and a Google search just to know what's happening in different bodies. And that can really become rather distorted quickly. And so I think helping parents map, okay, with my son, I do want to be able to teach him about his reproductive system. I want to teach him about the bodily changes he's going to notice in himself and in his peers. I want him to know about things like ejaculation, things like wet dreams. Like those are things that are kind of natural biological processes that can be quite confusing for some boys. And so that would be a good thing for them to know. And then for girls, obviously preparing them for menstruation, teaching them about their cycle and the rhythm of that, and what they can learn about their mood, what they can learn about future fertility based on how their body is created by God. And so being able to teach that in both cases actually allows kids and teens to begin to identify if there are problems in those areas, if there are things that need to be addressed and attended to. But it takes it a little bit deeper than sexual intercourse. Here's what it is, right? I mean, certainly that's something both will benefit from learning about, especially, you know, as they get a little bit older. And yet I think there are some pieces here that we can talk about with everybody, like the fact that our bodies are changing and we're going to notice it in ourselves and other people. And there's something really ordered and good about that. And it can also bring up a lot of other feelings. So again, mom and dad are a great place to bring those feelings to.
And what would you say to a parent who has a child who maybe has experienced or seen, you know, pornographic material or has a very distorted view of sexuality? How would you help the parents help their children?
So what we're seeing, unfortunately, is most kids and teens will be exposed to pornography. So it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. For any of us who were not exposed to pornography, that would be very rare. And so parents expecting that and being able proactively to identify spaces and places where that's likely. So if a kid is going over to a friend's for a sleepover, if they're hanging out with a cousin who's a few years older, if they have access to a phone or an iPad that has internet, they are going to see things on there. And so parents can teach their kids again ahead of time. And I talk about that in the book, that there will be times where they will see imagery online or a friend might show it to them that shows naked bodies. And sometimes it's showing naked bodies engaging in sexual acts. And when that happens, just so you know, again, I would love to know about that so we can help you figure out what to do with that imagery, because it can be really confusing. It can also be really exciting to see it. And so you're, again, you're kind of mapping for a kid what they can expect in that terrain. And it doesn't have to be explicit. It's kind of detailed as that. And then if they've seen pornography, and again, I think a lot of parents think they would know. I don't think a lot of parents would know. So I think sitting down as your kid is on technology and you know they're using the internet at high school, especially they have friends who talk with them about these things, to say to them, you know, I'm aware that many teens come across pornography, and usually the first time that they see it, it's accidental. They stumble upon it or somebody shows it to them. So my guess is that's happened to you at some point. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that's been like? So you're opening the door and you're assuming it's happened, instead of assuming it hasn't happened and saying, so when that happens, let me know. At that point, it's a bit harder for them. And then, of course, if a teen, if a parent comes into a room and a teen's viewing something, the best thing you can do is be as calm as humanly possible and say, I see that that's on the screen. let's both take a break. And, you know, we'll talk about this in a little bit, but I'm going to give you just some space. I know that can be a lot to have me walk in this moment, and we'll be able to make a plan for what we do from here. Mm-hmm. So being able to buffer against your own, honestly, your own kind of reactions, and also recognize that for teens that can feel very shameful and very exposing, which is part of why pornography is not helpful. Mm-hmm. And then, so being tender with them, especially if they're not excited to talk to you about it. I mean, I think we as adults have to take the lead in modeling that we can have hard conversations instead of expecting a teen to just gush and open up about all pieces here. So yeah, that's a little bit of what I would say there.
Right. Yeah. And just very important to note, like you were saying, that just the attitude is the whole thing, you know, and I didn't, you know, I don't think about that ever, but I think it is important to remember that, you know, our gut reaction is going to be something alternative to what the children might think, and it's just good to approach it from a calm demeanor. I think that's a really good point that you made. What kind of advice would you give to parents when they're talking about sexuality, when they're talking even just about relationships in general, because I know that families have different rules. Like some parents won't let their kids date through high school. Some parents just think that's okay, but just as long as you're with people, all those things. What would be some suggestions that you would make based on your experience that will ultimately be beneficial for the teenager going forward, going into these new relationships and trying to live those relationships well?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're exactly right. Parents have different rules, and I am a big fan of parents figuring this out kind of in their way. And so I think there are different ways to do it. I do think dating rules and relationship rules can create an illusion of control for parents. Like if I ban it, it's not going to happen. And I'm delaying something here and protecting against something. And that is a bit naive, unfortunately. I mean, many people will date in high school when there are restrictions against dating. The only difference is they do it in secret. What that does is it prevents the parents from being able to use those moments as teachable moments. Mm-hmm. And so that's the framing for me, is if you are going to allow dating, it is a really good rule of thumb to allow for contexts that are with your family, with friends, social events, you know, reducing one-on-one time, because teenagers have a hard time with that. And we probably all have a harder time with that than we care to admit. So I think being able to set up context for datings where it doesn't become insulated. And if you're noticing that, to give that feedback to a teen, it seems like you're on your phone a lot more. It seems like you're texting this person and I don't hear you talking about your friends. And do you notice that? What's that been like for you? Recognizing that some of that's developmental. And what I see a lot is because there's a ban on dating or it's delayed, teens will then hit their college years and their young adult years, and they go through that adolescent phase of dating then. And it can be a bit more tumultuous, and they don't have parents to come home to and process those pieces with. So I think there's value in having some flexibility kid to kid with how you think about age restrictions and those pieces. But there's another piece here to consider, which is most teens don't date exclusively in high school, but teens are going to be in situations where there's, you know, physical intimacy available to them, wanted or not. And we often forget that we need to prepare them for that as well. And to do so in a kind of way that honors their innocence, to say, you know, sometimes you may like somebody and they may like you, and they may, you know, touch you in a way that feels good and also feels uncomfortable. And so when that happens, those are, again, things that we can talk about and think through and figure out a plan for. Mm-hmm. you know, sometimes if you're at the store or walking through the mall, there can be a stranger who does something inappropriate, and you might feel bad about that, like you did something wrong. Well, just so you know, that would not be your fault. And I will never punish you for telling the truth about things that happened that were outside of your control. And so you're, again, you're cueing in recognizing that outside of the realm of one-on-one dating, there's a lot of things happening in high school that can be in that realm that kids need help figuring out. And the more open those lines of communication are, the better off you're going to be in helping guide your teen.
Yeah. I like how you said, you're not going to be in trouble for this, but let me know. Because I think that's a massive fear for most of teenagers. And I mean, even just the fear of disappointing, you know, like it's not necessarily whether or not you're going to get in trouble for it, you know, but there is that, there's a healthy disappointment, fear of disappointment, but then there's also kind of a very serious fear of disappointment. So I love really what you said there about that, because I think that's really important for parents to even remember when addressing their children. Your child probably already kind of feels like they're going to disappoint you if they bring this up to you. And so having a little bit more compassion in that area.
Right. Yes. And we frame, you know, moments where teens don't speak fully about what happened as lying a lot of times. And I think we forget that reflexively they're trying to please sometimes because they're afraid. And it's almost like, you know, hitting their knee with a hammer and saying, oh, look, that moved. It's like, wow, that does happen, you know? And so I'm reminding parents to just give teens a buffer, like, hey, just so you know, if you ever tell me something that you look back on and you think that wasn't the full story, there's like a you know, week window that you can come forward and just say, or a month window, or, you know, there's never a time where you can't come forward and say what really happened. And I will always receive that and be grateful for that honesty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one thing I do think of my parents when I think of just telling the truth to them, like they always affirmed that. And that's just even more so like with this topic, especially, it's like affirming the truth. And just, I feel then you're more inclined to tell the truth because you're being affirmed.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, so then just kind of rounding out the conversation, how can parents kind of help their teens embrace their sexuality and live it well amongst their peers and amongst their relationships and friendships in the midst, you know, of kind of what culture's feeding them? What encouragement would you give to parents? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm having two seemingly conflicted thoughts on this as we talk about it, because on the one hand, teens are developing adults, which means to expect them to be, you know, really integrate in their sexuality when they hit 18, to expect them to really have everything figured out in this realm through adolescence is a big ask, especially today with so many conflicting messages. So I think for parents, I want to encourage them to take a long-term view here and to normalize for their teens and with their teens some of the questions they're going to be asking. That doesn't mean that you're neutral about where you want them to answer their questions. That doesn't mean you don't teach them concrete information about sexual ethics, but you're recognizing that there's a developmental process here. And for most of us, when we were teenagers, we weren't completely sold probably on everything the church teaches in this realm. And we certainly probably weren't fully, perfectly living that out, let alone as adults. I mean, I think there are lots of challenges for people in the realm of sexuality. And so helping parents build that sense of expectation that this is a long-term process unfolding. And all we're trying to do is scaffold, give as much as we can to support our teen without having these fixed outcomes that by tomorrow or next week or next month, I really need you to have this resolved. So that's the first thing. The other thing I'll say is that one of the things I love about teenagers and what I love about the lives of young saints is we see teens' capacities to really radiate Christ's love and be virtuous at a time when we often talk about them as if they're not capable of much. Mm-hmm. And so holding out high expectations for teens that they're capable of growing in sexual stewardship, that they're capable of treating themselves in a more dignified way over time, that they're capable of dating in ways that is growing in maturity and respect of themselves and other people, that they're capable of figuring out what to do when pornography is there and available to them, that we can help them with that, make plans for how to manage those urges when they arise, that we trust them in this process, but we don't want them to have to do it alone. And that's the balancing act with teenagers. And so in that realm, encouraging parents to have clarity, and I try to offer this in the book, of what is a Catholic vision of sexual behavior? What is a Catholic vision of relationships? What's a Catholic vision of human desire and attraction? And how do we offer that in gradual, sprinkled in ways where teens are starting to get a more robust picture about sexuality, that it's not just about sexual behavior. It's not just about marriage. It's about my life is made to be a gift to God, to other people. My body communicates that giftedness. And whether I'm sexually active or not, whether I ever get married or not, that I can be fully alive as a sexual being, and that that has and places responsibility on me. And it also is a pathway to seeing people fully. Those are the things that I think we can offer teens that they're not going to hear anywhere else. But the more we offer a list simply of do's and don'ts, the more we set up scenarios where teens will just push back on those pieces.
Excellent. Do you have, can you share with us a little bit about where we can find your book and if you have any other projects or things coming? And then also for those of our listeners who are in Colorado, if with your services, if you want to share a little bit about that.
Yes. So people can follow my work on my website, which is easy enough. My first and last name.com, juliasadusky.com. I have an Instagram. I have a Facebook, and Instagram is probably the best way to follow speaking engagements that are upcoming for people local to Colorado. I have a practice in Littleton, Colorado. I often do 2-hour consults with parents, and I can sometimes see parents across state lines who just want consultation around questions of sexuality and gender with a teenager. So I offer those as well. In addition to that, I do speaking locally. And so I have a few talks coming up that'll be advertised on Instagram and on my website. And then I've written several books, and those are all available on my website and anywhere books are sold. So Amazon has Start Talking to Your Kids About Sex, Talking with Your Teen About Sex. And I do have a new project coming out with a colleague, Mark Yarhouse, and that's on sexual identity and the kind of expanding categories around sexual identity we see today. So how do people effectively walk with people, and what does the layperson have to know about those shifts to be more effective in this space? So that will be called Emerging Sexual Identities, and it'll be coming out through Brazos next fall.
Awesome. Wow. We're looking forward to that project.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on our show. And we were really grateful to be able to speak to you about this topic.
Absolutely. So good to talk to you, Mary Grace.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Podcast. In 2024, we want to reach as many people as possible. You can help by sharing this episode with a friend, subscribing to the podcast, or leaving a review. To learn more, visit us at ferrislovesshrine.org.